Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
I'm Sonya Rappaport.
And today, Sonya, we are in it yet again.
Mm-hmm.
Another slog through another...
First-class movie?
First-class movie. That's going to be debatable.
Yeah.
We're doing 2011's X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm.
Where to begin with this movie? It's a reboot of the franchise. A soft reboot. Because it's still... in the continuity somehow with the original X-Men series.
Somehow.
Right. So, as we all remember, X-Men 3, X-Men The Last Stand, was supposed to conclude the series forever, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the X-Men were dead. The movie stunk. We were just going to get Wolverine spinoffs. I think Fox's plan was they wanted to have the Wolverine spinoffs, but then they wanted to do a Magneto origin story.
Mm-hmm.
And a Professor X origin story, maybe. So then I think they just decided to merge all those ideas together, and this is what they came up with.
More is better.
Right, yeah. Well, or maybe just like... well, in this case, it'd be less is better, because if they wanted to have a Magneto and Professor X origin story, then just combine it into one thing.
You know what I'm saying.
Anyway, you know, before we dive deep into this movie... I want to say I remember seeing it with you for the first time.
Uh-huh.
In 2011 when it came out one summer.
Right.
And I remember enjoying it.
I remember being excited that the X-Men franchise was being rebooted.
Right, it was back. And they're
so we like ran out to the movie theater like, "All right, more X-Men."
I remember me and you were like the only ones in the theater.
Yeah,
there's like four people.
The only ones that were that excited.
Yeah, I mean, the movie did pretty well. I guess it had a high budget. It made like $300 something million.
Mm.
So it probably wasn't like the biggest hit, but, you know, there was something about this movie that was pretty decent at the time.
Uh-huh.
It was still like maybe. It's still like as good or better than your standard MCU fare. Because really. I think around this time, the only good MCU movie was Iron Man, which came out in 2008.
Hmm.
Then they had the sequels, well, Iron Man 2, which a lot of people didn't like. But then Thor and Captain America and the Incredible Hulk movies weren't exactly lighting the world on fire.
Mm.
Like, they weren't great. They're okay.
Yeah.
You know, the MCU really took off after the first Avengers movie.
I personally also didn't care about any of those other characters. I was fully invested with the X-Men, and that was it.
Yeah,
who they had made movies about. Unless you want to count, like, Batman, but
that's a whole different thing. Right, exactly. So, really, it's like, in a way, this movie, just by default, it was kind of, like, interesting. And as a superhero movie,
it had,
like, something going for it.
But then also, we had gotten some investment with, like, even if they weren't great, the previous movies gave you characters and consistent actors playing those characters, and then to get this was a little bit jarring for me. I remember walking out of there kind of being like, what? What did I just see?
It's really the first movie where they really start twisting with the timeline and the continuity.
Yeah.
You know, I walked into this movie thinking they're just starting the slate all over again. It's going to be a whole new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think now, watching this movie, is there anything that explicitly ties it back to the original movies other than the presence of Hugh Jackman? I guess like the character design and Mystique is consistent. Oh, and Jennifer Lawrence. Rebecca Romijn has a cameo again.
Yeah.
So there were subtle links to the original movies. In a way, actually, I take that back. The opening scene of this movie is
a direct
pull from X-Men 1. Yeah, and we'll get into that.
That was a weird thing to do.
And so this movie is directed by Matthew Vaughn, who I guess is more famous for Kick-Ass and the Kingsman movies.
Mm. I enjoyed the Kingsman.
You've only seen Kingsman 1, right?
Yeah, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, Kingsman 2 I thought was, like, it was okay, but... I don't know how I feel about Matthew Vaughn. That's a whole nother topic.
I feel like, without getting too far into it, Kingsman is a better version, better in a lot of ways anyway, an updated version of a spy, James Bond sort of genre.
Right.
And this is something, like, pretty entirely different.
So Matthew Vaughn is a British director, I believe, and I think The Kingsman represents more of what he wanted out of a superhero movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in Kick-Ass 2, he's playing with themes of superheroes and pop culture and stuff.
Yeah.
But someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I think Kick-Ass still was based off something. I don't think it was his wholly original creation. So I think The Kingsman is his creation. And that's him, like, doing what he wants to do, which is riffing on James Bond, riffing on, like, weird 60s bespoke culture.
Yeah.
Like, but updating it for the modern day.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Because this movie is supposed to take place in the 60s, a lot of it.
Right, yeah.
And I have a big problem with how little I felt like I was in the 60s
yeah,
when I was
too.
Watching a lot of yeah. this movie. They do the historical references and
JFK,
Cold War
Cuban
stuff.
Missile Crisis.
But
misogyny.
Right. But even the misogyny is, like, on purpose to make a joke.
Misogyny doesn't play well in this movie. It's not... It's, like... There's a lot of things
it's
wrong with this movie.
It's too heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And the costumes I've found to be very... like
too modern,
like 2000s era for a lot of the teenage, well, I don't know if they're teenagers, but the young mutants in this movie,
it's a big, I called this movie anachronism men, you
yeah.
know, like it's just everything's anachronistic. The young people in the movie just seem like modern young people from
not
today.
Just the way they dress, but their mannerisms, the way they talk also.
Yeah, their humor is, like, there's a joke Jennifer Lawrence's Mystique has, and we'll talk about her, where she says, she's defending Beast, and she's like, you know what they say about men with big feet? Your feet look pretty small, Alex Summers.
Yeah.
And I think that, I don't think that was a joke in the 60s. I think that's more of a modern thing. I mean, I could be wrong.
Who knows,
it just seems
that,
out of place.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem, like, of the time. It's just, it doesn't work as a period piece.
No, but also jokes like that are kind of pepper, or not even jokes necessarily. I don't know what to call them. Lines of dialogue like that are peppered throughout this movie.
There's a lot of improvisation that seems just like kids from the late 2000s or the 2010s improvising.
Yeah, exactly.
The direct Matthew Vaughn's like, okay, you're a bunch of kids hanging out. You're cool. You're mutants. Just like hang out and have a party. And they're just, all right, the actors are, like, charming and decent for the most part, and
yeah.
but they're just acting as themselves. They're not, it's not of a time, of an era. It's messed up.
Which is fine. It doesn't have to be of a time, of an era, but then don't make such a big deal out of it when it comes to the political situation. Just set it in the present day if that's what you want to do.
Well, yeah.
Don't worry about the timeline so much.
I
know.
You're right. It was just something, they should have just rebooted the X-Men completely with new characters, new setting, whatever. Just give us something new.
Yeah.
Instead, they're like, they did make a point to say this is the prequel to the X-Men movies you know. And in the next movie, Days of Future Past, they link it together, like, inseparably.
Right.
It's the old cast plus the new cast. So, and that movie, I think, is better than this one.
It's, the thing is that modern nerd culture, I guess, comic book culture, whatever it is, like, a lot of it, there's, like, a very heavy nod to the fans,
mm-hmm.
but it's not, I feel like it wasn't done well in this case.
No, it was still, like...
The nod to the fans is, like, remember Rebecca Romijn as Mystique?
Yeah.
Like, remember Hugh Jackman as Wolverine? And it's like, yeah, obviously
remember,
we all remember. You don't need to point it out.
Remember,
like,
how we...
Movie.
Yeah, remember how we, like, what Cerebro looked like in the first movie? Is like, here's the origin of Cerebro.
Right, yeah.
Here's the origin of Magneto's helmet from the movies, not, like...
I mean, it's here. The same thing I think we've said about other movies, but it's... Like, part of what makes the original set of movies or original content good in the first place is that a lot of things are alluded to that don't need a full explanation. This was the big issue with Star Wars,
right.
The modern Star
yeah.
Wars movies, right? Like, it becomes a rich universe because they're alluding to a whole bunch of other things that imply a rich life for all these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go and explain each of them one by one... It flattens everything out.
Yeah, you're talking about Solo mainly, and
yeah.
Rogue One to an extent.
Exactly, yeah. But I feel like a little bit of that goes on in the X-Men universe
yeah.
also.
I mean, this is what the difference... So, a lot of people love the X-Men movies. I'm up and down on them, as listeners have heard. To me, the difference between the X-Men movies and a great MCU movie mm-hmm. is this. The people who make the MCU movies use the comic books as a spiritual and like as a spiritual Bible for which to guide all creative choices. So, and at the same time, they're updating those movies because they're set in like the fictional present day. You know, they're set for a contemporary audience.
Yeah.
But really, everything in the MCU movies, as much as possible, is on purpose and very much like considered.
Mm-hmm.
You can go, like, for instance, in Iron Man 1, he goes through an evolution of the Iron Man suits as we see them in the comics through the decades.
Yeah.
And it's not in, like, this way that... It's, like, done in a clever way. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. You know, like, these touchstones are there for all these characters in all the MCU movies. And they're very careful about capturing the correct tone as presented by Marvel Comics. And Kevin Feige, the guy, the maestro behind the scenes of all this, has said, he's like, we just always go back to the comics whenever we're in doubt.
Yeah.
You know, like, and he has faith that the comics got it right the first time.
Yeah, that's why people love the comics.
Right, and that's what we've said time and time again throughout this show's history and us talking about the movies and stuff, is that really the comics, they hit it out of the park mm-hmm. for the most part, and there's no sense in changing core things from the comics. I mean, you can change things, and it's smart to change things at times, but it has to make sense and it has to remain true to the spirit. Now, the fundamental problem with the X-Men movies is the creators. And like I said, some movies are better than others. They don't hold to this principle. They don't hold the source material up as the paragon of drawing all their inspiration.
Yeah.
They seem to, like you said, they draw their inspiration from themselves, from the movies they've made.
Right.
As if it, like, means more to the audience.
A self-referential thing. I mean, part of it might be for audience members that didn't watch X-Men TAS or didn't read right. comics, and so the movies are their only frame of reference, so they're doing a little fan service to, like, the new audience, yeah. maybe. But I think also a TV show and a movie are extremely different from a director's point of view, because a movie director is trying to make his mark, his or her, one day, mark, where, as, like, in a TV show, it's not, the pressure isn't as high, you know? Yeah. Like, a movie director is trying to develop their own
put
style
their stamp on
that they're
it.
Known
yeah.
for and hopefully get more movies from.
I mean, that's what DC does. They hire Warner Brothers. They hire directors mm-hmm. to direct these DC movies, and the directors are auteurs for the most part, and they want to put their own stamp. Sometimes it's good, like yeah. Christopher Nolan
right.
in the Batman series. Sometimes it's bad, like Zack Snyder and all his movies. But it's like the director's vision.
Right.
In Marvel, they don't do that. They've got a committee of people led by Kevin Feige. A lot of them are Marvel comic book writers, creative types, and they make damn sure that everything, like, connects, makes sense, is, like, true to the comics, is true to their brand.
Right.
And that has, like, a bad effect, too, because there's the problem is their host company now, Disney, is a bit too, like, it's got the Disney gloss.
Yeah.
So the violence is tamped down, the interesting situations are a bit tamped down a lot, you know, like, but they always get the characters right, in my
yeah.
opinion.
I think, it's not that I'm trying to put down artistry amongst directors, because
right.
it's, obviously, there's a place for it, you know, where it can be really great and flourish and become really, you know, part of the genre of cinema, or whatever, mm-hmm. however you want to say it, or, you know, like, not even that highbrow, but, like, something unique and special unto itself. The problem is that this source material already has artists behind it.
Great artists.
So,
iconic artists.
It
iconic
feels
stories.
Like too many cooks in the kitchen when a new artist is putting their artistic stamp on pre-existing.
Without drawing enough from the original.
Yeah.
So, and it's like, you know what? Why X-Men and X-Men 2 are among my favorite X-Men movies? Maybe it's because Kevin Feige was a producer on those. And there was no precedent for them as well, so they had to draw more from the comics as an inspiration, but while updating them in a way that makes sense. You know, it's like at the end of X-Men 2, they were setting up the Phoenix Saga line, but in a way that could have fully lined up with the comics in a new, interesting way. You know, not quite the same as what we've seen, but the emotional stakes were identical.
Yeah.
And it felt like, wow, this is exciting. We're going to get the Phoenix Saga. What we got was X-Men 3. It sucked. And what we're going to get is Dark Phoenix, which doesn't look any better. But, like, the point is, like, Feige was there.
Yeah.
He had a fucking clue about what to do. I also know Bryan Singer is obviously heavily involved, and he's a producer on this one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. His frame of reference was the X-Men cartoon show.
Right.
Whose frame of reference was the comics.
Mm-hmm.
So something is lost along the way. Now, having said all that, and we've set up a lot of negativity here for X-Men First Class, I remember seeing it with you originally and liking it,
mm-hmm.
like a lot of people do, for a bunch of reasons. Like, the main reason is the acting. And the casting.
Yeah, the casting was great.
Which is, like, the absolute, like, touchstone of all the X-Men movies is the casting has always been phenomenal.
Yeah.
They get incredible, interesting B-plus A-list actors. You know, even their unknown, and some of their unknowns become big stars. Hugh Jackman was not unknown, became a big star. Jennifer Lawrence was a relative unknown. She probably did one thing before this, became a huge star.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so much for the X-Men, but it, like, dovetailed with her Hunger Games stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they hire, like, these other really, like, top, like, A-list on the verge actors, like Michael Fassbender.
He's amazing.
Right.
In all of these movies.
And James McAvoy. James McAvoy, too.
The two of them really hold it down.
Yeah. All the actors in this movie make this movie better than what it is. Because I'll say right now, the script is terrible. The editing is pretty bad.
Mm.
The dialogue is terrible.
Yeah.
And there are some performances in this that aren't good, too. So
some of it might go back to editing, though, like you said, or dialogue or script. You know, it's hard to separate it out. I think the actors are really doing the best with what they've got. And I don't know, I wasn't let down by their performances.
Right.
Considering everything else.
I think their performances, at the time I originally saw it, transcended the bad script. But now, watching it years later, this was a pretty tough movie to get through for me. I was rolling my eyes at a lot of it,
yeah.
And I was annoyed at, like, a lot of things it could have done better.
Mm.
So let's go through it. It starts in 1944. It's, like, a recreation of the opening scene of X-Men 1, where you see young Magneto in the concentration camp.
Mm-hmm. Using his powers to try to get to his mother, and
right.
He bends the gates.
And then they show you essentially what happens next.
Right.
So,
which you don't get in X-Men
right.
1.
And I think this is a bad scene right off the bat. Kevin Bacon is Sebastian Shaw. He's been, I don't know how much he's been rewritten from the comics. I don't know much about his origin from the comics. I know what he's like in the Phoenix Saga in the classic comics. He's a little different here. So, you know, I don't like Kevin Bacon in this movie. I think he's way over the top. And I like Kevin Bacon, but I just don't like his part.
Okay.
His power is pretty accurate to the comics, I guess, but
I feel pretty ambivalent about him.
Yeah, okay, but I just didn't like this opening scene. So he brings Eric, the young Eric, into his... He's a Nazi doctor for some reason, named Schmidt, and he changes his name to Shaw.
Right.
And he's obviously researching mutants. He's a mutant himself. And I just don't... I thought he was cartoonish. So in the power of the scene in the first X-Men movie is that there's an element of, like, fucked up realism.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the Holocaust, World War II. It's a slice of alternate history with the Marvel, like pixie dust on it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to trivialize it, but you know what I mean. Like, it wasn't, like, too much. It was
right.
just, like, a snapshot. Here, it's, like, by picking up the next scene and just showing this goofy, over-the-top Kevin Bacon, like, twirling his mustache with Nazis and, like, killing Magneto's mother in front of him.
Yeah.
It's cartoony to me. And it strikes a wrong note.
Okay. I see it.
I mean, I this is part of Matthew Vaughn's style. He'll go to these type of places. You see it in Kingsman a lot. He shows a lot of, like, weirdly taboo stuff and interjects it with sex and violence and over-the-top, like, weird psychopathic characters and things.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it didn't work for me. But whatever, we're getting the origin of Magneto. So this is like, I'm sure like half the script is like the Magneto origin script with the Professor X origin. So then, meanwhile, Professor X origin, he's 12 years old or whatever in 1944 in Westchester, New York, living in his ginormous mansion.
Mm-hmm.
He catches Mystique breaking into his house, disguised as his mother.
Who's dead, so he knows it's not her.
Right. Did he say she's dead, or he's...
Oh, I thought it...
He says something like, she would never be in the kitchen.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe she is dead.
Oh,
I don't
maybe
know.
She's not. I don't know.
Right. She's not a present mother. Anyway.
Do we know why he has a British accent?
That's a good question you asked. So he must have just moved to America. Like, why Professor X is British, as even though he grew up in America. I like his accent.
Is that part of the comic origin?
I don't know.
He British?
I'm not quite. I remember in the original, like, origin, the Juggernaut comic from the 60s, they show a lot of his childhood. And he's his parents divorced, or one of them died or something, and Juggernaut's dad married Professor X's mother for her fortune.
Right.
And I don't think they're, like, talking much about if he's English. I mean, it was all taking place in America, because Juggernaut's clearly American.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There's something strange about Professor X. I mean, he's got a Scottish name, right? Charles Xavier. Is that a British name? British, Scottish, whatever. You know, in the continuity of the X-Men movies, Patrick Stewart plays him.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, it's fine. I'm not going to, like,
okay.
get quibble about if he's
if there
British
was,
or not.
Like, more to the backstory that I didn't know.
I mean, this is what I'll say about Professor X. The best performance, and I love Patrick Stewart, is still the actor from the X-Men cartoon, at least in terms of the voice. Because it's almost like the guy who does – it's a Canadian actor, obviously. I forget, I remember the actor's name. But I just remember that he was married to Catherine Disher, who does Jean Grey in real life, and then they got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned that like 4 times in this podcast. Anyway, I just think this Canadian guy does Professor X, like, really nails a mixture of an American and British accent in a way. You know what I'm saying?
Hmm.
It's a commanding American accent. It's not quite like a mid-Atlantic one. Like,
no, but there's something more formal about it.
Yeah. So, and in a weird way, that is like a good, like, compromise, like, between is Professor X British or is he American?
Hmm.
Here, he's just flat-out British, and he remains British for the rest of his life, even though he grows up in America. I think a kid, even if he moved at age 12 to America with a British accent, his accent would change over time. That's just me. In my opinion.
Depends on the kid,
That's,
I guess.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. So right off the bat, like, they're shoving Mystique into the main continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of her being Magneto's friend, because she's a bad guy, as we know, in general, she's Professor X's friend for years.
Right. Well, she, like, lives in his mansion with him, apparently.
Yeah, and it's like, it's a fact
she's
that's,
like, homeless and trying to steal food from his kitchen, and
right.
he's like, you never have to steal again.
Right, I thought I was the only mutant.
Yeah.
I mean, if this is all the same universe, why does Professor X, why does Patrick Stewart not remember Mystique so much in the first ones?
Yeah.
I mean, so this is the first, really one of the first instances of messing with the continuity in a way that's just, like, you have to suspend your disbelief. I mean, it's weird. It's like people don't like Jennifer Lawrence in the new X-Men movies because she's a superstar. So they make her a main character, and that's not what Mystique is in the X-Men story.
Yeah.
But in this first movie, they made the choice to make her a main character, and Jennifer Lawrence wasn't a big star.
Right.
So it was a choice. I don't get the choice. I don't know why Mystique, the character, had to even be in this movie.
I don't know. We knew her from the previous movies. Maybe she, like, tested well with audiences or something.
I mean, I guess the idea is that Mystique is Magneto's ally in X-Men 1, so they're explaining the origin of Magneto, Mystique has to be there on some level.
Yeah, and I guess they wanted to make a story where it's, like, someone crosses over to the dark side sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right, so let's talk about Jennifer Lawrence.
Okay.
How do you feel about her in this movie and overall? Let's have a Jennifer Lawrence discussion.
There's just, like, a lot with Mystique. There's a lot of, despite her not being, like, a huge character in the, or, like, a main character in the comics.
She's a cool side character in the cartoon and in the comics.
But she does have a rich backstory that, like, they don't really give her a lot in this. Like, she has a lot of screen time, but not a lot of story exposition, I guess. I don't know. Jennifer Lawrence, she's fine.
You like her as an actress?
I mean, as an actress, I don't know, but I think she did the job in this movie. Like,
I think she's anachronistic in this movie too. She's just seems like a modern girl, not a child.
The 60s thing doesn't come through. But, like, Rebecca Romijn really wasn't given any, like, personality or dialogue, right? In, like, the previous X-Men
movies. I think her personality came through in her performance.
Yeah,
which was cool. Like, she did a lot with having no lines.
Right. So I don't know, did they, like, balance it out with this? Like,
it's like now they want to give a bigger part to this character, poor Rebecca Romijn, that she doesn't get it. You know, it's a much meatier role.
Yeah.
I don't like her performance in this movie. I think she's doing what she does as an actress well. Like, she's playing a young woman of our generation, and I mean, like, millennial. You know, she seems like it's realistic to that.
Yeah.
It's not realistic to a character that is similar to Wolverine in that she doesn't age and she's kind of immortal in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going through the time periods, it doesn't seem true to that character. She doesn't seem like she's a product of the 50s or the 60s or the 40s.
I agree with that.
And
she also gets some bad dialogue.
The dialogue's bad for her. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, maybe it's editing, but there's a couple of times where she, like, starts a sentence that doesn't make sense in the context of the conversation that's going on, you know? Like, they're all standing silently, and all of a sudden she looks at Beast, and she's like, "And Beast, don't you know, blah, 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 blah," some, like, declaration, like,
yeah.
What do you mean, and? There's no and, like, there's nothing happening before. I don't know, there's a few things like that where they give her dialogue that
I'm just wondering, like, what to say about Jennifer Lawrence in general in the X-Men series going forward, because a lot of fans hate her now. I think that's the right word. It's strong, but they do. Do they hate her because it's Mystique is, like, should not be this prominent, or they hate her because of her acting and the choices she makes?
I mean, Mystique's prominence doesn't really have anything to do with her. The script is written. She can play it or not play it. You know, she can take the job or not take the job, I guess, is the way it is.
Well, that's the funny thing. Then, she's paid enormously well for these movies. Like, this is her payday movies.
And then there's the whole thing with her, like, not liking the blue makeup.
Right, and not wanting to even be in the movies. She just wants to take the money. She doesn't care.
Right.
That doesn't
really bother me. It's like, if she wasn't a fan before and she was just like, oh, this, like, movie I got offered, let me give it a shot, and then who cares about that?
But she keeps agreeing to do them. Like, why did she agree to do Dark Phoenix?
She's paying her tons of money, I'm sure.
But I'm saying, but if her private attitude is like, oh, I'm above these X-Men movies, I've won an Oscar, I'm above this, like, why does she keep coming back for more? Like, that's kind of strange.
Because they're well paid.
I guess. I know, right. That's the reason. So she's doing it for the money.
So, like, is that the thing? Like, everyone hates her because how she is off screen about it? Like,
well, she's got a lot. She's taken a lot of hits in general for her real life persona.
Yeah.
Because she's real, I don't know what the right word is. She's just kind of, she seemed like, her whole thing, this is how she got famous in a lot of ways. She seemed like a very down to earth, real person.
Yeah.
Like and she was young, like a teenager when she got famous.
Right.
And she won an Oscar, and, like, everyone's, like, caught up in the fairy tale, and she really, like, spoke her mind, and, but then it got, like, I think
she got annoyed with the downsides of fame, and she didn't stop speaking her mind.
Right.
And
she was instead of complaining about just, like, being a person, she's complaining about fame and, like, all the trappings of fame.
Yeah.
And that's just, like, a classic thing that people get sick of and they turn against young ingenues.
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm sure the same thing happened to Elizabeth Taylor and, like, whoever else was, like, the next It Girl.
I mean, you know, everyone's got problems, so whatever.
I know, but it's like, who wants to hear about Jennifer Lawrence, like, bitch about things?
I mean, so, like, don't follow her on Twitter or whatever it is.
Yeah, but she's one of these characters, like, that's, you know, like, on BuzzFeed. Like,
don't read BuzzFeed, then.
I know.
Just turn off the social media, and you don't have to listen to her. It's fine.
I'm just trying. I don't want to be unfair to her, because, like I said, this is default attitude X-Men fans have, and I consider myself among having had this attitude at times. Like, fuck Jennifer Lawrence, you know? Like, Mystique sucks. Like, she sucks. I mean, I'm trying to give it a fair shot.
I mean, I am, too, and the best I can really come up with here is ambivalence. Again.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe it. It's ambivalence. She's not awful. It's not her fault, and it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and her off-screen presence, like, is of no consequence.
It's irrelevant.
To me.
Right. We just have to judge her on the movies, and it's just kind of like, it's a mixed bag of performance.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. All right, so let's move on. So they grow up. We cut to grown-up Magneto as Michael Fassbender. He's in this Swiss bank with some Nazi gold, which is kind of appropriate to the Magneto character. We talked about in one episode recently, like, one of my favorite scenes ever of Magneto, like, on his side adventures in the comics was mm-hmm. him, like, levitating a huge mountain of Nazi gold that he confiscated yeah. from this evil Nazi guy.
Right.
And he just flies off in the distance. And it's like, that to me is awesome. Like, that's what Magneto's all about.
Uh-huh.
Here, it's, you know, he's got a bar of gold. He's trying to track down Shaw. He wants revenge.
And
it's a great, you know, so let's talk about, like, one of the things that works about this movie is Michael Fassbender, because he plays Magneto with this real nervy intensity.
Yeah.
A real, just, like, thin man's rage. Michael Fassbender is a great actor. I mean, I
think he brings it in this movie.
Yeah, he really does. And that's, like, why it's... But it's too good, because they... He's good in Days of Future Past, but then bringing him back for Apocalypse didn't quite make sense. Apocalypse should have just been the villain of the Apocalypse movie. Why
we'll
is Magneto
there when we get there.
I know, but... And then he's back for Dark Phoenix. Like, that's,
yeah,
like...
I know.
He shouldn't be in Dark Phoenix.
Yeah.
So he maybe did too good of a job that, like, okay, he's part of the cast. He has to come back. He should be... Magneto should be... The character, like, he should be the star of the show.
I mean, Ian McKellen was great as Magneto, too. They really got, like, top-notch actors that role.
Let me just put it this way about Fassbender. Is he the main villain in any of these movies of which he's the star? The answer, I think, is no. In this movie, the main villain is Shaw.
Yeah.
Magneto is more of a central character, but he is not the main villain.
So?
This is my point about Magneto.
Uh-huh.
There's not been, like... Since X-Men 1, Magneto was the main villain. There needs to be a Magneto movie.
I
could do with more Magnetos being the star villain of a movie. In Days of Future Past, he is a side character, not the main villain. The main villain is, like, Trask and the Sentinels, and Magneto's, like, doing his subterfuge from the side.
Mm.
Same thing in Apocalypse. He's not the main villain. In Dark Phoenix, he's not going to be the main character villain. You know, it's like, why... Fassbender hasn't been given a movie of which to star as the main villain, which is kind of... He's like the anti-weird hero friend of Professor X. We'll get into more of that. Anyway, that's just a point I'm making.
There's a lot of villains. Whatever.
So, I mean, so Magneto's, like, side quest is to hunt down Shaw. He goes to this bank. That's a good scene, I thought. He rips out the guy's tooth and, you know.
Yeah.
He's, like, he's hunting down Nazis. It's, like, a good... It's, like, allusions to Boys from Brazil, which is a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
About hunting Nazis and cloned Hitlers and things.
Yeah.
There's a lot of allusions to that, I would say, in this movie. And he goes to Argentina later to fight, kill some more Nazis and stuff. And that's, like, again, like, a nice mix of historical fiction there, where a lot of former Nazis who escaped the war, they fled to Argentina and established, you know, communities there and stuff,
yeah.
German expats.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, like, you know, if you watch Boys from Brazil, where, like, I don't know if this is real or not. I'd have to read more, like, history. But in Boys from Brazil, there's a scene where... who's the main the main Jewish Nazi hunter? I think Sir Laurence Olivier is the actor.
Mm-hmm.
He's fucking incredible in general, and in that movie, obviously.
Yeah.
He, I don't even know if he observes it, but there's a scene where the Nazis are having, like, an anniversary, and you see, like, these old Nazis in the 70s, like, with Nazi banners and flags at hotel, just toasting themselves and, mm-hmm. you know, like, remembering Hitler.
Yeah.
Like, that's scary, creepy shit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's entirely true, but I like to believe that's true. And so you get a taste of that in this movie.
I like to believe that's true.
Well, I just think in terms of, like, I'm just saying, like, it just seems like it could have been true.
Uh-huh.
Like, creepy, like, Nazi shit going on in the 70s, you know? Like, fuck these people. Anyway. So that's what Magneto's up to. Oh, and then there's another major character we meet. Rose Byrne is Moira MacTaggert, who's rewritten again.
Yeah.
So we saw her in X-Men 3. She's a scientist, as she should have been.
Yeah.
Here, she's a swinging 60s CIA agent. Again, another anachronism in my view.
Yeah, I don't like her as American, and I don't like her as a CIA agent.
Absolutely.
I do like her as Rose Byrne.
Yes, Rose Byrne. Again, well cast, great actress.
Yeah, and she does well with this part, I think. I just wish that the part were a Scottish scientist.
Right.
Like, she
should be. Like, Professor X's love interest that he meets along the way. I mean, like, you know, in his adventures. I would have been... Okay, so let's just say what would have made this movie better, in my opinion. It's not... Do not emphasize X-Men. do a Magneto Professor X origin story where they're the two main characters, and everything else doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The origin we get in 10 minutes or 5 minutes, maybe even less, in the X-Men cartoon, where you see that Professor X is explaining his past with Magneto in, like, episode 2 or 3.
Uh-huh.
He says, we met at, like, a... We're at a refugee camp from a war in Europe.
Right.
And we were friends, and we worked together to help heal former prisoners and refugees overcome their PTSD and things like that.
Yeah, that's a bonding experience.
Right, and only through circumstance did we reveal our powers to each other. We didn't realize. And so they've built up their friendship through this other experience.
Yeah.
And they're secret mutants. And that's when their divergent philosophies come out.
Right.
And it's fucking interesting.
Yeah.
This movie, not so much.
Right.
We'll get to it, but their friendship is really abbreviated. The circumstances of how they become friends is dumb.
Yeah.
And it's just not...
Magneto spends a week at his mansion.
We'll get into that, yeah.
And then they're old friends.
Right, then they're old friends for decades, even though they don't see each other for like another decade between this movie and the next
one. All right.
So it just could have been so much better, is my point. And Moira MacTaggert could have been a character... along the way. Like, to me, a good movie is, if you're going to do historical, show Professor X in the Korean War. He's a Korean War veteran.
Yeah.
You know, like, do that. That's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Have his stepbrother Juggernaut be a random side character, you know?
Yeah.
Like, with Magneto, show similar stuff. Like, show him maybe have an affair with the woman in Eastern Europe where his children are Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch. You don't see them. They're babies or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, get into his backstory
right. And
stuff like that. There's just, like, it could have been more focused.
Yeah.
And their paths could have crossed in a more interesting way. Anyway, so back to Moira MacTaggert. So she's not a Scottish scientist. She's an American CIA agent. It's just, again, it's an anachronism to me that in, like, this takes place in 1961 or 62.
Mm-hmm.
To think that there would be a femme fatale CIA agent, field agent,
mm-hmm.
such as Moira MacTaggert, it's just not believable to me. That might be, I don't know if the CIA had like female field agents like her.
I mean, according to James Bond, they did.
Right, but...
I don't know.
Maybe
they did, but...
They might have, but it just doesn't seem viable. It doesn't seem realistic to me, for whatever reason. The script doesn't sell it enough.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, and so right away she's in Vegas, and she's chasing this guy, Colonel Hendry, who she suspects is a double agent.
Mm-hmm.
He's in charge. He's like a prominent voice in the American Nuclear Missile Command. And she sees him go into this casino with Sebastian Shaw and Emma Frost, played by January Jones. And she immediately strips to her underpants to, like, you know, because there's, like, a stream of prostitutes or whatever. And it's just, like, it looks cool, but it's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just don't get a feel for the 60s. You know, they're playing 60s music. It's a 60s casino. Still just doesn't feel right. I mean, maybe I've seen too much Scorsese, like, good period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, too much prestige television like Mad Men and things where it's just done so much better. It's such a finer eye for detail.
Yeah.
Here it's like Matthew Vaughn's like stylistic version of the 60s, you know? He's like doing...
It's updated 60s,
right,
kind of.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I don't buy Moira MacTaggert. It's kind of a letdown for me.
But anyway, so she...
sees January Jones, so let's talk about Emma Frost.
Yeah.
So again, the continuity is fucked up because we were just introduced to Emma Frost in Wolverine X-Men Origins. She's the sister of Silver Fox.
Yeah.
And it's like the 1980s. She's a teenager. Here she's like transplanted to the 60s, a totally different character. January Jones is terrible in this part. It's sad.
Uh-huh.
I really loved her in Mad Men.
I know. She's still playing Betty Draper in this.
She's giving no... I don't know if she's such a bad actress, but she's giving no effort in this part.
Well, the thing is, she's supposed to be, like, cold and icy or something,
yeah.
Right? And I feel like this is her, like, literal interpretation, or maybe it's, you know, the director's literal interpretation of what a cold, icy...
But I don't think Emma Frost, the character,
like,
I don't know if the White Queen is supposed to be... She's cold in that she's a villain. She's a villainess.
Yeah.
But
also, like, not very emotive.
Well, no, she is, like, emotive, though, I think, in the comics. She's very...
In the comics, I'm saying the performance here.
Right,
like,
yeah.
The coldness is, I assume, supposed
she's
to
playing,
be portrayed.
She's playing it all
this,
over
like,
the map, though, because she's like she's in this weird misogynistic relationship with Sebastian Shaw, who bosses her around and treats her really crappy, like makes her get ice, yeah. and she has to smile at him all the time. And
again, it's like a Bond girl thing. Isn't
yeah.
that weird though? Because she's so powerful.
Yeah, like
in
why
situation.
Is she?
She has her full set of powers: the diamond thing,
mental
plus the
telepathy,
mind reading
yeah.
thing. Like
she shouldn't have her diamond powers yet. You
she
know?
Shouldn't. But even the telepathy thing on its own is like
yeah,
yeah.
Why
it's
is
awesome.
She? Why
it's like
does
an
she?
Awesome power. Why is she so subservient?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, in the comics, she's in the Hellfire Club. And she's subservient to Shaw because I think the Hellfire Club is like this elite group of rich mutants that are high society mutants.
Yeah.
So it's like in that sense you could believe her being subservient to Shaw because he leads it and she wants to like network
yeah.
in a way. But even in those comics she's got her own agency and she's not – she's her own person. And she gets annoyed. Like, all the people in the Hellfire Club in the comics are all angling for power.
Yeah.
They're all trying to backstab each other.
Right.
Emma Frost, no exception.
We don't see that here at all.
Nothing
Shaw
like that.
Shaw is really the undisputed leader of
He's
the gang.
A total dictator.
Yeah.
I mean, Kevin Bacon plays him as really venomous.
Yeah.
So he captures that, but it's just there's no wiggle room for other characters. The script is bad. Mm. You know, the dynamic relationships are not interesting. Anyway, January Jones not good at her job. I mean, she looks flawless.
Uh-huh.
She looks like a comic book character. Her, you know, her body be banging.
Uh-huh.
Whose quote is that most famously?
From Playing House.
Right, yeah, oh yeah. An obscure USA television show. Yeah, I mean, January Jones is a supermodel turned actress or something.
Yeah.
A
real Betty Draper.
Yeah, I mean, she looks gorgeous. She's wearing the lingerie that
oh,
the white...
Oh, she doesn't become an actress, I guess.
Right,
anyways.
Yeah. She's wearing the lingerie that, you know, the White Queen is famous for.
Yeah.
Kind of inexplicably at times.
I know, that's the thing. Is like, I know it's a reference to the comic and what she's supposed to look like, but then in the real world, which is not quite the 1960s, it looks like really strange that she's just hanging around in her underwear all the time.
And it's just
in Russia, it's...
Right. You just can't get around... the bizarre choices she makes... the actress, just none of it makes sense.
Yeah,
it's just really strange. So it's a bummer that Emma Frost hasn't been done correctly.
Yeah,
and then they just kill her off in the next movie. You know, so it's like they're like, all right, enough of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, the overall plot of this movie is that Sebastian Shaw wants to influence U.S. and Russian officials to. He wants the U.S. to put missiles in Turkey and the Russia to put missiles in Cuba. So that a nuclear world war will start, which is like a close enough parallel to the real world events of the missile Cuban crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he wants a world war to happen so that the entire world nukes itself, but only mutants will survive. Which I guess the movie posits that mutants can survive a nuclear war.
That's the implication.
Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, so I guess he's only referring to mutants that don't live in major cities. Because if you're in a major city, you're getting nuked. You're not going to be able to survive a hellfire of fire unless you're Wolverine or the character.
Or Shaw.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, all the mutants that are going to live are going to live in a non-populated area. And then you're presuming to... I mean, is it something in the comics? Like, correct me if I'm wrong, can mutants survive an irradiated planet where everything is poisoned? They have to eat and drink water.
Or is the implication that, like, this generation of mutants will not, but then, like, the next generation will mutate again to
yeah,
survive.
I'm not quite, it's just like it's a real shaky thing. I think the movie is trying to posit that mutants can survive radiation at the very least, that they're immune to radiation. They show a scene later in a sub where he's grabbing onto the like uranium like
well,
rods.
No, that's because of his particular.
I know, but there's
though.
A scene. I very specifically saw Emma Frost was in that room as well. She would be needing if she was not immune to your radiation, she'd have to be wearing a
like a hazmat suit.
Yeah,
or
exactly. So I guess maybe the movie's saying that mutants are immune.
I mean, I could like maybe buy that if it was like I don't like not a world where you're born with a genetic mutation, but you know, like a Spider-Man sort of thing where you're exposed to some energy or toxin or something, but
it's the next stage of human evolution is what mutation is. As we've said, it's like it's been alluded to in the comics and in the cartoon that it's because a lot of the the Atomic Age had a lot to do with it, mm-hmm. which is kind of cool the way the comics, like, work out. The first comic came out in, like, 1961, 62.
Yeah.
And that's, like, almost 20 years after the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. And so all the kids are coming of age.
Yeah.
Professor X was born before. There's a few older ones. But that's kind of, like, a cool, like... That's what is X-Men's genius in general.
Yeah.
Like, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby knew... They had a brain between the two of them, you know? Uh-huh. They were really smart.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Whatever. Like, that's another thing. It's like, this movie, it's like, makes more out of, like, the Nazis being the premise. Like, not really, but, like, when you're going back to the 40s, they're showing, like, the Holocaust and things because mm-hmm. of Magneto. But really, it should have been more about the Manhattan Project as, like, a touchstone.
Yeah, that would have been pretty cool.
Like, more of, like, an allusion to, like, the birth of mutation, you right. know, give us the origin of that.
Yeah.
So, okay, another missed opportunity, I guess. Anyway, so he's got this, like, band of evil mutants, Shaw, Azazel, who is, I guess, turns out to be Nightcrawler's father.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like,
with
the red...
Mystique.
Right, yeah, he's the red Nightcrawler. So that makes... I mean, they line that up in the movies to make sense. This guy, Riptide, whose name is never said in the movie, I'm pretty sure.
Tornado Man, as they call him.
Right, yeah. Any other characters? It's just... And then Emma Frost and Shaw, right? It's just them. Okay, so they're the bad mutants. So, I mean, like, they kidnap this Hendry dude, they blackmail him into supporting this plan. Moira MacTaggert witnesses all this. She contacts the CIA and says, look, there's been teleportation and mutants and stuff. They think she's out of her mind.
So she goes to find Charles Xavier because he's a leading expert on mutants. All right. And
so here we are introduced into James McAvoy as the adult Professor X.
Yeah.
He's just getting his doctorate, I guess at a very extremely young age. You know, like, because he's a genius, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And his doctorate's on genetic mutation. He's been living with Mystique all these years. They're, like, brother and sister, mm-hmm. more or less. And he's, like, this real cad. So, again, it's like, I think Matthew Vaughn had this idea for another... He wanted to do a James Bond-type movie.
Yeah.
Like, a young James Bond. Instead, he's, like, has to work with the X-Men. So he makes Professor X this, like, swinging... party dude.
Uh-huh.
A cocky British lad.
Right.
Who likes to get drunk, likes to hit on ladies, and likes to show off his intelligence, and likes to show off his powers. And it's a pretty fun scene when he's introduced this way. You know, he's at a mm-hmm. bar, he's hitting on this gorgeous woman who's got, how do you say it? Heterochromia?
Mm-hmm.
She's got two different eye colors.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous because her eyes are blazingly beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Like, one is bright, like, radiant green, and the other is bright, radiant blue.
Yeah.
That, you know, those are contact lenses or something, or CGI.
Mm-hmm.
No one, I don't think, has eyeballs that.
I like that word, radiant.
Right. Is that a real word?
Or I don't think radiant, so. I think you just made it.
Very good. And so he's hitting on her. It's funny, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good... It works. I mean, James McAvoy is great. He's a super charming, great actor.
Uh-huh.
But then, like, a wet blanket, Jennifer Lawrence enters the scene, and she's jealous, and she stops him, and she, you know, she's vying for his attention. He kind of forcibly drags her out of the bar. He's like, you mustn't, like, show off that way.
Is she not allowed to drink? Like, is there something where she can't support alcohol?
I don't know.
Because in this scene, and then in another scene when they're in a bar... He, like, keeps ordering her Pepsis or something. Like,
he's very controlling of her.
Yeah.
He's so stern to her. She's really interested in him. He is not interested in a romantic relationship with her. He's kind of disgusted by her, actually.
Yeah, he doesn't like her blue form.
Yeah, he's too grossed out by it, which seems really out of character for him in a way. I mean, I guess, like, you're attracted to who you're attracted to, but at the same time, he seems to be very... like, traditional
mm-hmm.
in his rejection of her.
Yeah.
But, like I said, there's something, like, she is thrown a wet... She throws a wet blanket on this interesting portrayal of this young Professor X.
Mm.
Like, she snaps him out of, like, a more fun scene. And he has to... He's, like, stern. He's like, you mustn't show off your powers. But he was just doing that. So he's a hypocrite, too.
Yeah.
So I actually feel for Mystique's character here that he's kind of, like, a jerk.
Mm.
But it's just... All right, so I want to talk about the relationship in general between Professor X and Mystique in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just, like, a big misfire, like, speaking to the stuff I just said.
Yeah.
A lot of it is just... It's poorly written. He doesn't listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's technically his first student, his first ally.
Yeah.
And he doesn't... seem to have much sympathy
for
her.
And even at this point, it's like, despite being portrayed as, like, a fun-loving party guy, like, she says to him, like, hey, man, I'm your only friend.
And she's like an anchor around his neck, but she seems like a really cool, fun person to be around. Like, why are you dragging her to England while you're doing your studies all... Like, what are you... Why?
That's another thing that's weird, is that everywhere he goes, she goes to...
Yeah.
To the CIA and a little bit here, and, like, anywhere he goes, she's there.
Yeah, she's his teammate, but he doesn't seem to, like, appreciate her.
Yeah.
And...
Well, that's why she gets pissed eventually.
I know, like, rightfully, but he's embarrassed by her. But, like, why is she need to be around him?
I don't know.
Right. So, it's just bizarre. The whole relation, the fact that they were together first. And the fact that, like, he really complains about it in the next movie, too.
Yeah.
He's, like, jealous that Magneto took her away.
Right.
It's like, dude, you pushed her out the door.
All right. You don't know what you got till it's gone.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the general plot. I just want to talk briefly about the scene in Argentina when Magneto kills, like, all the Nazis in the bar.
Oh, yeah.
The music is really good in that scene. It's really, like, scary and ultra, like, it suggests ultra violence.
Yeah.
And Magneto's, like, shooting guys with their own guns and, like, stabbing them in the hand and the chest and being really gross. But, like, there's no blood.
Yeah.
So this is, like, what you get for a PG-13 movie. It's, like, a totally bloodless scene, but it's suggesting, like, straight up Tarantino.
Yeah.
But you don't get the visceral...
blood
payoff,
spurts.
Which I think is a problem in
really?
These type of... I mean, I do, like...
I don't.
It doesn't work for me when you have these bloodless scenes.
Oh.
I think that's why Logan works. It's like, I don't know. Comic books have a lot of blood, even the relatively tame ones.
Uh-huh.
It's one thing they can show, you know, they...
I know. I think despite that, they did a good job of, like...
The music suggests
tension.
It. Yeah, and the acting by Fassbender is good that you kind of gloss over it.
Yeah, he's
but
great.
Still, like, I don't know, it doesn't quite work for me. Another, like, detail that I like is how Professor X uses his power. Like, he always has to touch his brain.
To let you know he's using it.
Right,
otherwise, he could just be using it all the time.
But I like how they show it.
Yeah.
It's like he sees into your mind, and it's like this weird faceted crystal scenario.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it's
a little kaleidoscopic effect.
I like it. It works.
I like it too.
It works for me.
Because I think in the comic or in the TV show, they show it in other ways, right? They make it like a little shining star in the middle of his head or something. Like
a blue force field around his skull.
Right. Like, you can't do that in this movie, even if you wanted.
You could have. I mean, you could have. There's lots of ways to show it.
You could have, but it would have been cheesy if it had been, like, an exact replication of the rendering from
the comic.
I think
there's many different ways to do it. Yeah, I think in here it's great. It's a nice touch. I mean, you know... Matthew Vaughn, like, for a lot that we're going to criticize this movie, he's a director with, like, a vision.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got moments. I don't like, in general, that they chose to have him not bald throughout the whole movie and the whole next movie.
Yeah.
I just... Part of it is, I mean, in the comics, he goes bald at, like, age 12 or something.
Right.
And I like that from the sense, like, maybe his, like, mental powers are so intense that it, like, melts his hair off his head. And that's not exactly what happened in the comics. He's just bald for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But I just don't like him with a full head of hair.
I mean, it's one of those things.
And he makes jokes about it and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's, like, all these nods to the audience or whatever. It's one of those things where they want to have an opportunity to explain why it happens,
but it doesn't need to be explained.
I know.
It's part of his character that he's this weird, bald guy with crazy eyebrows. So I'm not, like, into the headed Professor X.
Okay.
I mean, the hair-headed Professor X. So then, like you said, they go to the CIA. Rose Byrne meets them at a bar and is like, I need your help. They go to CIA. He gives his little presentation on mutation. CIA obviously still doesn't buy that mutants exist.
Mm-hmm.
But then he starts showing off his powers. There's like a stupid cameo of William Stryker's father as one of the CIA agents.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I never caught that until you pointed it out this time we watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Professor X is reading their minds, and he, like, says, like, classified military shit, and it causes them all to freak out. They think he's a spy.
Mm-hmm.
And only until Mystique uses her power do they believe them.
Yeah.
I think it would have been actually a more fun scene if he said... If he kept trying to prove his mental power without causing them alarm. He's like, think of a number between 1 and 10 trillion.
Yeah.
I'll get it every time, you know? Like, that would have been more, like, fun to me than, like, the way it plays
out. Expedient.
Yeah. And then it's like...
And less dramatic.
Right. And then It's like it's fun to play with the powers.
Yeah.
And I think it's like you could like stop a movie and and indulge in the fantasy element of the wish fulfillment. You know, what if you could read minds?
Right.
And they do that a little bit here at the CAA because he starts like using his powers on different characters.
Uh-huh.
But it's not as fun as it should be. You know, we're meeting Professor X theoretically for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Let him like do some fun stuff. You know, like have like a whole sequence of him like using his power on random different people, like a custodian or a
I mean, a we guard. Get that later on, that type of scene, what you're talking about, like fun with mutant powers.
Yeah.
With like the crop of mutants that they're going to recruit. You know?
Yeah. And that's like done okay.
Mm.
All right. Anyway, so, and then it's like, weirdly, we're introduced to this other character, Oliver Platt shows up, who mm-hmm. I like as an actor.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, I've been also studying mutants in my spare time. I'm so happy to finally meet you in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm going to run this operation now. And I don't, like, get why he's even a character in the movie.
I know.
He's killed off quickly, too, later on.
Like, the CIA is a character in this movie.
Yeah.
And, like, is that necessary? Because it's a dumb conceit for Moira.
Right.
Oliver Platt doesn't really need to exist.
I think what would have been fun would have been if, like, Moira is, like, shit upon in the CIA because she's a woman.
Yeah.
How about Professor X go in there and just, like, brainwash everyone to, like, keep promoting Moira MacTaggert, like, inexplicably, to then she gets to command her, like, command the X-Men division.
Yeah.
And it's, like, just this funny thing where he keeps, like, she's like, I don't have authority to do that. And he, like, touches his brain. It's like, you do now. It's
yeah.
like, and someone walks by. It's like, great news, Moira. Congratulations, promotion to, like, field director. And she's like, what? You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, why do we need this Oliver Platt dude as the, like, bridge to whatever the next scene is at the
right.
CIA? It just...
I'm just saying, why do we need the CIA?
Yeah,
make Moira a scientist. Professor X has, like, you know, we're going to get the Blackbird and, like, the training facility at the X-Mansion and all
yeah.
that stuff. Like, why is the CIA involved?
I don't know. I mean, the only answer I can give to that is that in the first comic, when Magneto, in the very first issue of X-Men, when Magneto's attacking the military base, I think there's a scene where Professor X contacts his, like, allies at the Pentagon.
Mm.
So there's always been, like, this, like, bridge. The Professor X is, like, tied in with very important people in the American government.
Yeah.
Because he's a good guy. Like,
I guess they need it for, like, that missile scene at the end, right? No U.S. government, no missile scene.
I don't know. They could have still... That still could have all played out.
Yeah.
Without the CIA being a character, like you said. I just... Right, I don't like it either.
Right. Well, anyway,
so,
there it is.
Right, they're in the CIA. They meet Oliver Platt. He introduces them to his top scientist, Beast. Hank McCoy, played by Nicholas Hoult,
mm-hmm.
who Jennifer Lawrence was, like, weirdly dating in, like, each of the movies, but they would break up between the movies in mm-hmm. real life. I just always thought that was strange. Excuse me, they were even engaged at one point. What was I going to say? Oh, so Professor X outs Beast accidentally.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, I can't believe you actually have a mutant working for you.
Uh-huh.
And Oliver Platt's like, you're a mutant?
Yeah.
And then we get Beast's great reveal. He shows his feet,
right.
which never made sense to me, because his feet... His enormous feet, which look good in terms of, like, how you would
CGI
represent the original
stuff.
Human Beast in a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like, wow, that's pretty believable.
Uh-huh.
But, like, somehow they're encased in a pair of shoes and socks.
Yeah, regular size shoes.
And socks. Like, he pulls the sock off and his feet grow, like, 20 times larger than the sock should contain.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the actor that plays Beast, Nicholas Hoult. It's pretty, you know, he's got a lot of...
Yeah, he's good. I mean, for me, the biggest thing that bothers me about Beast here is that he's working so hard on the formula to cure mutant appearances.
Right.
Like, yeah, Jennifer Lawrence, I could understand she's conflicted. You know, she's blue, it's going to be hard to fit in, people
yeah.
don't know about mutants, she'll be judged, blah, blah, blah. This dude just puts on shoes
yeah.
and he looks like everybody else.
I mean,
like,
I can,
why does he need the big cure?
I mean, I can imagine that being a problem in his teenage years where he's trying to, like, you know,
yeah.
you're a kid in high school or something, and although they say he graduated Harvard at age 15.
Right.
Which is true to the character in that he's super intelligent. They imply that his intelligence is part of his mutancy. I don't know if that's true to the comics.
Hmm.
I think... Someone's going to have to let me know. I think he's just super smart, and he just happens to be a mutant with the Beast powers.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I guess, whatever. Everyone's got their thing, but...
Yeah. he's, like, you know, outside of Professor X, he's one of the only original first-class mutants in the movie.
Yeah.
you know, this time, I wonder if the X-Men First Class comic came out before this movie. I think it did. So Marvel relaunched X-Men, like a new series called X-Men First Class, where they just did a bunch of, like, the 60s characters. They just showed further adventures of them. And I think it was a pretty cool comic in a way, you know?
Mm.
It was just like a new series where you just got to see more adventures from the young X-Men, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, they brought those characters into the main X-Men continuity at some point, too. Like, there's a time travel thing. So all of a sudden, the old X-Men had to deal with their younger counterparts in the present day.
Mm.
And that was, like, a really cool idea. And then, like, lots of stuff happened to him. Like, Iceman came out as gay. You know, the young Iceman, which
right.
caused the older Iceman to, like, reevaluate his own life and say, yeah, I guess I am gay.
Hmm.
Like, stuff like that. So, like, it was, like, a cool idea. I think that comic might have predated this movie, actually. But we don't get the original X-Men, which is a shame. Anyway. So, Beast is... They meet Beast. He's designing a supersonic jet for the CIA, which turns out to be the Blackbird. And also, like... and then, okay. Then, right away, it, like, cuts to this Strike Force mission.
Right.
Where... they're trying to hunt down Shaw. The CIA is not behind this at all. But Professor X, like, I guess he brainwashes Platt to, like, get, a, like, an army team together to intercept Shaw's submarine.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, by the way, Shaw killed Colonel Hendry, showed his powers, whatever.
Yeah.
So, Magneto is also there, too. He's trying to kill Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this nighttime scene where this is where Magneto and Professor X meet each other. You know, Magneto fails to kill Shaw. He gets away in a submarine with Emma Frost. You know, this is where Charles and Magneto meet.
Mm-hmm.
He brings Magneto back to the CIA. They all become friends. And this is where, like, the timing of the movie gets really stupid. Because how much time elapses in these scenes... Like, where Professor X and Magneto become friends. Like,
yeah.
2 weeks?
No, it's, like, 1 week. Because Jennifer Lawrence, like...
But that's later. That's during the training sequence.
Yeah. But, oh, yeah, yeah. You're right. You're right. Yeah. Anyway, it seems, like, not that long.
Right. So they are friends. You know, Magneto's happy to meet another mutant. And Professor X is like, I understand your pain. I can read your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So Magneto feels, like, a kinship to him. But still... Their whole friendship seems like a rushed.
Yep.
You know, there should be a lot more to it. And then what else happens?
They show us Cerebro.
Oh, right. Beast builds Cerebro in like a day.
Yeah.
He builds it out of a radar station. And he's like, let me shave your head, Professor X. He's like, no, absolutely not. Don't touch my hair.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever.
All right.
He uses Cerebro. We see like some dumb cameos. Like we see a young Storm,
uh-huh.
which wouldn't make sense continuity wise. She looked like she's 12 years old.
Yeah.
In the early 60s, which doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan is to track down other mutants to fight Shaw, I guess.
Right.
And
so that we have the montage of
right. We meet the characters.
Magneto and Professor X going around finding all these different characters.
Yeah. We also get a scene in the submarine with Shaw, the origin of Magneto's helmet.
Yeah.
He says, like, oh, the Russians built this for me. It blocks telepathy.
Right.
That it leads to more questions than it answers. Like, how do the Russians invent a helmet that blocks telepathy? You know, are there other mutants in Russia that they're testing it on? Like, it's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the helmet looks dumb on Shaw. It should only ever be worn by Magneto. I never liked that in the movie. And there's, like, another dumb scene where Mystique and Beast, they have, like, a flirtation going on.
Yeah.
Mystique is really happy to meet him. Beast is, like, he's too nervous to, you know, Mystique's coming on way too strong for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he proposes, like, I'll make a cure to cure our appearance.
Yeah.
And I just hate this one line of dialogue. This is, to me, emblematic of why the dialogue's so bad.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about already.
Right. They're both saying at the same time, didn't you ever wonder what it'd be like? And they say at the same time, to feel normal.
Yeah.
And it's just like the most cliched. They look at each other googly-eyed. It's like the most cliched, dumb line in a movie like this you could write. And Magneto interrupts them. He's like, you don't need to look normal. You look great as you do.
Yeah.
And that's like, every time Magneto says something to Mystique, she's like struck to her core.
Yeah.
He says everything she wants to hear to the point where she's shaking,
mm-hmm.
you know? What else is... Oh, all right, so anyway, so now Magneto and Professor X set about their plot to find other mutants. The first mutant they track down is Angel, played by Zoe Kravitz, who is the daughter of Lenny Kravitz and, I guess, I forget her name in real life, Denise from The Cosby Show.
Oh,
Lisa Bonet. Sonya's in the other room real quick. She's washing her hands. Lisa Bonet. Oh, yeah, that's her name, right?
Yeah.
Right. So they're like two genetically perfect human beings in real life. I just thought I'd say that. So Angel's like a character from the Grant Morrison comics. The character of Angel in the comics is like a really ugly girl. Mm. I think purposely so.
I like that better than this.
Right. Here she's just like a stripper who's like really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, nothing against the actress. Again, like, she does a good job with what she's given, I think.
Yeah, like Zoe Kravitz.
It's just such a, like, a common trope of, like,
It just doesn't, none of it, it just doesn't, it's just a whole anachronistic scene, this montage of them in the 60s recruiting mutants. First of all, this background music they're playing, it's like this weird, like, modern techno song.
Yeah.
I never liked this musical choice. You know, play a 60s song of something.
Right.
And maybe it is. Someone say it's, oh, it's like the instrumental from like a, you know, a Fifth Dimension song. I don't know. But Fifth Dimension is a Birds album, so a Birds song. I just don't like it. It doesn't, stylistically, it doesn't work for me. The world of the 60s they go into does not seem realistic.
Mm.
So, but first they track down Zoe Kravitz, and they find Darwin, who's a taxi driver. He actually seems like he's from the 60s.
He's the only one.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because Legion, the show, the FX show that we have talked about a couple times.
They do all this stuff better.
They do all of it, like, impeccably, and they don't even say that it's the 60s or make, like, direct reference to it. They just, like, get it.
You're absolutely right. Legion, it's stylistically the 60s, but updated, but in a...
But it's, like...
ageless time.
Pitch perfect.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. And it's weird, and the weirdness is, like, a character of the show, you know?
Yeah, right.
They find Alex Summers, who is Havoc. So they twisted the continuity, the classic continuity around. Alex Summers is supposed to be the younger brother of Scott Summers. I'm just not a fan of this character and of this actor who plays him. He's too... He just doesn't seem like one of 60s character. He doesn't... There's nothing to his character. He's totally bland in a way. He's just kind of like a confident jockey dude.
Yeah.
And his power doesn't look right, in my opinion. I mean, I hate to be a nitpicky comic book fan, but to me, Havoc is like one of these really otherworldly characters.
Mm.
He shoots these, like, white concentric circles from his chest that sort of irradiate. I always pictured it kind of slowly in a way.
Mm.
And then he could generate them from his fists, like, faster to make a force beam. But he's just always kind of like, it's just this weird, you know, Jack Kirby energy coming from him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very 60s and it's very unique.
Yeah.
And here in this movie, it's like he shoots these red flying discs that kind of look like Cyclops' optic blast, but in circle form.
Right.
And it just doesn't look right. And it's just bizarre to me.
Well, the thing is that later he needs to get a special suit engineered
Which
by
is true
Beast
to the comics.
To be able to focus the energy.
I'm not sure if Beast designed the costume in the comics.
It's still not concentric circles after they do that, except for the design of the outfit is.
Right.
But then it is that energy blast. And
it looks
like
Cyclops' optic beam.
Yeah, they do
from
that on
chest.
Purpose to, like, make that connection for fans who know Summers, whatever.
And then in two movies from now, they do establish that he's the older brother of Scott. But the timeline of that's all messed up and, like... Because, like, 30 years or something passed between this movie and the third one, and then Alex Summers looks, like, 3 years older, and Scott looks, like, 4 years younger than him.
Yeah.
So none of it makes sense.
All right.
So I'm not too big of a fan of Havoc here and what they did here. Again, it's, like, not doing right by the comics. I mean, like, the backstory of Scott and Alex is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents were kidnapped by the Shi'ar. You know, his father's Corsair, Starjammer. They had a They had a parachute out of an airplane over Alaska. They're split up, put in orphanages. You know, it's a fucked up story with Mr. Sinister.
Yeah.
And there's a lot. You can just, like, hint at that stuff. You don't have to go there.
Yeah.
You can hint at it in an interesting way that would make everyone happy.
Mm.
So whatever. And then we meet Banshee, who is the biggest anachronistic character in the whole movie. In the comics, Banshee's introduced as, like, a middle-aged Interpol detective
right.
from Scotland, right? Oh, no, he's Irish.
Irish, yeah.
And he's, like, he owns a castle because his family is royalty. His brother is Black Tom. You know, he's an interesting character. He's the boyfriend of Moira McTaggart
mm-hmm.
at some point, which is a little rivalry, Professor X. he's a freelance mutant. He's got his own costume. Mm-hmm. He joins the X-Men as, like, a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
In Giant Size X-Men, where he appears. I think he might have appeared before that, too, in some other issues. But anyway, here he's a teenager from 2011, acting in a movie that takes place in 1962. He's American. He's got no hint of Irishness, other than his red hair, I guess, and the way he looks.
Yeah.
He might be an Irish actor, American-Irish actor, but... I don't know what's to say about him. He just seemed like out of place. Yeah. I mean, the one thing they do right is his costume with the wings looks comic accurate, and him flying around is like okay. They kill him off in the next movie too.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like, why have Banshee if you're gonna do him like that? Whatever. Hugh Jackman makes his cameo, which is funny at the time when you saw him in the movies. He says, go fuck yourself, and they go to sit down. They introduce himself, which they weirdly make a bit out of that in the next movie. Like, they reference the scene. But I just, again, there could have been a better way to do it. I get it's a joke just to have Hugh Jackman for 2 seconds, but why would they go, it's just bad screenwriting. This is my problem with it. It's bad screenwriting.
Mm.
Why would they go all out of their way to find wherever the hell Hugh Jackman is to sit down with him and walk away immediately when he says one line of dialogue?
Yeah.
Like, just because someone says, go fuck yourself right away, like, he'd say, wait a second, we know you're a mutant.
Right.
He could have reacted to that and, like, got really violent and aggressive. There could have been, like, a quick, like, fight at the bar. Something. You know, like, I mean, like, otherwise don't have him in that scenario. Have him as a different cameo. Have it, like, him just walking by in some scene where something crazy just happened. You know, and he's like, oh, wow, wonder what happened here. And he just, like, gets in a car and drives away. Yeah. You know, like, just, like, it doesn't, the way it's set up, it's just not good script writing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
All right, so that happens. And then it's like all the new X-Men are assembled. And they're hanging out in the CAA, and they're giving each other their code names, and it's a lame scene where they're just improvising, I guess, just hanging out, showing each other their powers. It's just it should be charming because the actors are like all good young actors, and it should be fun, but it's just not fun and charming to me because it's just so anachronistic. That's the word I keep coming back to here.
Do you think it's improvised? Do you know that for a fact?
No, I don't know for a fact, but it seems improvised to me.
Yeah.
It just seems like Matthew Vaughn said to them, hey, you're a bunch of, like, cool kids, like, hanging out, getting to know each other, like, have fun, like, you're mutants, just, like, react, you know, cut it loose.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, but they're not, it just doesn't seem period specific. I don't know how else to put it.
Right. They could be Nickelodeon kids.
Right, yeah. they seem like, you know, grown up, right, like Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah.
From the 90s, not from the 60s, Mickey Mouse Club. So, you know, and then it's like another scene where it's like Jennifer Lawrence is annoying when they destroy half the room and Professor X shows up. She's like, you're Professor X and you're Magneto.
Mm-hmm.
And Magneto's reaction to that is dumb. He's like, exceptional. Like, I don't know, like, what kind of weird reaction is to that?
No.
And then Professor X is just, again, disappointed in Jennifer Lawrence. Like, she can never do right for him.
Yeah. What does he say to her? He's like, I expected more from you something. Which is just, like, such a weird dynamic because apparently they're the same age, but, he all the time acts like he's 40 and she acts like she's 15.
And she very well might be older than him because the way her body ages.
Yeah, right.
Like, so even though we're introduced to her, she looks like she's a little girl. She could be 20.
Mm.
She just hasn't aged into an adult body yet.
Yeah.
Again, they could have made hay out of that. That could be interesting.
Right.
Like, where the little girl's like, I look like I'm 12, but I'm really 22. You know, it's like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get older or something. Yeah. And he's like, well, you know... Like, that's weird. And that would be weird. And you're like, oh, wow.
Right.
And then you cut to, like, later, it's like, wow, I'm happy that I'm, like, actually aging a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, like, something that, I mean, I think calling attention to that stuff is interesting.
Well, they do have the one scene where Hank tells her, he, like, looks at her cells through a microscope, you know, because he took a sample of her blood or something. And he's like, oh, when you're 40, like, you're still, your cells will still be, like, they're 20 or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, he does explain a little bit, but.
Yeah. But.
Here, so I guess she's aging at the right age now, but she later her aging will slow down. I guess that's the point.
No idea.
No idea either. By the way, let's talk about like poor Mystique. She goes after three men in this movie.
I know.
Professor X
aggressively.
Yeah, aggressively. Three guys each. She throws herself in Professor X's lap. He like, rejects her completely and then acts like a stern asshole to her the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Beast, she, like, sits on his lap, too, with her, you know, like, sexy body and everything. And he's just, like...
He doesn't know what to do with that.
He doesn't know what to do with that. And then he says that when he invents the cure, he says the wrong thing to her. She's like, shouldn't we just, like, maybe think about this? Like, accept each other for who we are? I think you're really beautiful. And he's like, I'm sorry, but we're not beautiful. We're ugly, even though they're, like, beautiful, symmetrically faced people. he's like, and she's like, she turns into a blue person. He's like, no one will ever accept you as a blue person as pretty.
Yeah, and then she turns back, and he's like, now you're beautiful.
Yeah, and it's, like, so fucked up. Like, I you know, in that scene, what I would have done if I was her or if I was writing this movie, I would turn into an ugly person. It's like, you know, just because I picked this form, that's not who I am either. I could be this ugly lady, too.
Right.
And just... You know, like, show him he's an idiot.
Yeah.
So he rejects her. Mm-hmm. And then she throws herself in Magneto's bed later in the movie.
Right.
And turns into Rebecca Stamos.
Uh-huh.
Rebecca Romijn. She divorced Stamos. And he's like, well, you're too young. Maybe in a few years.
Yeah, that's why she turns into Rebecca Romijn. So that she looks older. And, like, he's still, not into it.
And then he, like, bizarrely convinces her that, like, she should be a nudist. Like, we get the origin of her, like, the why she's nude all the time. Because in a lot of this movie, when she's in her blue form, she's wearing a robe or other clothing.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. Like, why... when she's a kid and she has no clothes, like, I mean, that still doesn't quite make sense to me. Maybe she's just, like, a ragamuffin orphan, you know? But, like, still, like, orphans have clothing. They're not nude.
Yeah.
Or, you know, runaways have clothing.
But then when she turns into Rebecca Romijn and he still rejects her, then she's like, okay, pass me my robe. And he says something like, would you cover up a magnificent tiger?
Would a tiger hide its stripes? But she's not a tiger. She's a human being. I mean, like, human beings wear clothing. It's a convention that goes back to the caveman days.
Right, exactly.
It's not like... It's part of, like, human psychology is to... I mean, like, obviously there's nudists, you know. But, like, it's embedded in human culture to the point where it's part of human psychology to clothe.
Yeah.
I don't get why Mystique... And in the X-Men 1 movie, I think, or something, she says something like... no, Nightcrawler asks her in X-Men 2, it's like, why don't you just appear like everybody else? She's like, well, we shouldn't have to. Okay, fair.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't explain the nudity. I mean...
I mean, what you're saying.
And it's just it's by coincidence that her mutation covered. She doesn't have nipples,
right?
And her vagina is, I guess, covered too.
I don't know. We never see it. Really.
She must have a vagina because she can have sex, and she's willing to have sex in her blue form.
Uh huh.
Right. We never see her vagina. Obviously, we don't see her vagina.
Yeah. Right. So.
But I mean, the way the makeup is, it like it makes it seem like she's covered in these blue scales.
Yeah.
I don't know. She's kind of sexless in a way.
Right. She's like a Barbie figure. A blue one.
I don't know what's going on with Mystique. Anyway. I'm just saying, her nudity, like, never made sense to me. In the comics, she has a fucking white dress.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because she's a human being. Human beings wear clothes.
Right. With skulls because she's a bad guy.
Right, yeah.
And it's awesome.
Yeah, like, why, again, we've asked this many times, why is she naked in these movies?
Right. Well, that's why it's funny because then, like, she's naked in her blue form and she shows up in Professor X's kitchen or whatever, you know, and he, like, averts his eyes. Like, he reacts like a normal person.
But not when he's a kid. When he's 12 years old, he's fine with her being naked.
But, like, as an adult now, in this continuity, like, in this scene.
Right.
You know, he's like, oh, put some clothes on, and he averts his eyes.
And she's like, you reject me because of the way I look. But no,
maybe in general he does.
Yeah.
But at that moment, it's because she's naked, not because she's blue.
Right. Something is not making sense. So then at this point in the movie, there's, like, they go to Russia trying to get Shaw. They catch Emma Frost and they arrest her. You know, Magneto cracks her diamond form somehow with the metal bedposts.
Yeah.
Like, should you ask the question, should those metal things be able to crush diamond?
I think no. Isn't there a whole thing where they have to, like, make... To cut diamonds, don't they make a blade out of diamond? Because it's the only thing... I don't know either.
So Emma Frost is taken out of the movie, in a sense. She explains the evil plan to the X-Men. They're surprised.
Yeah.
And then... But at this point, like, so they're off in Russia. Shaw invades the CIA to try to influence these mutants to join his side. And it's, like, this really disturbing scene where there's this huge massacre at the CIA.
Yeah.
Like, a mass killing of, like, 100 dudes guarding this entire facility.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, guy after guy dies. And, like, the way the young kids play it, they're, like, genuinely terrified. They're, like, they're playing it for total realism, you know, and it's a really scary scene.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle's like, okay, I'm not here to harm you. Like, join me. And Angel does. Which, you know, okay, maybe one of them is bound to think that, like, you know, why are we helping out the humans? Or they hate us.
Well, he also, you know, tries to make it glamorous. You know, he's like, stay here with the people who don't care about you, or join me and, like, live it up, you know?
Yeah, and then he's like proto-Magneto, and it's explained later in the movie that Magneto agrees with him, except with the exception that he killed his mother, so therefore he must die, but I'm going to follow your plans, though, and your philosophy and stuff.
Yeah,
so,
and steal your team.
Right, so he's just about to leave with Angel and say, all right, fine, you guys stay here. But then Darwin's like, we better attack him.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it makes sense, because he just did, like, murder, like, 200 people.
Right.
Like, he deserves to be punished. So him and Alex cook up the scheme, you know, it's like a double cross. And anyway, Alex shoots a Havoc blast at Shaw. He catches it in his hand or something, and then he takes like
he uses that energy and like puts it inside Darwin's mouth,
which looks pretty awesome and scary.
Yeah,
like Darwin's death is really like cool looking and like, but. Like, first of all, you killed a black guy. You know, like, what a dumb thing. Right. And then, you know, like, in every movie, like, it's like the black guy is always the first to die for some reason. And then, like, why is Darwin's power not adapt to it? I don't get...
Yeah, I don't get that either.
It would have been cool if he survived. I don't know. Like, why does Darwin have to die?
I don't know.
I don't know either. So, Darwin's dead. And then, like, the X-Men, like, what are they going to do? The CIA, they obviously can't stay there. They decide to... Professor X wants to disband them all and just say, it's all been too dangerous, we got to give up on this. But I guess, is it Mystique that convinces them to form a team?
I don't even remember.
I think, like, something like, hey, remember you've got this, like, 100-room mansion, like, that's, like, totally isolated? Let's all go there, because none of us have a home.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to train them there. And then we get, like, a pretty decent training montage.
Yeah.
It's pretty well done. You know, Professor X is being a teacher.
Right. Banshee learns to fly, and...
Which is... those are humorous scenes.
Havoc learns to control his energy beam, and Beast learns to run fast.
Right. Like, it's pretty shocking that, like, I mean... I don't know if Beast's power is to run that fast.
I don't know either.
He's got super... All right. Beast has super strength. He's got super agility. He's got super feet that can cling to any surface, pretty much.
Yeah.
I don't know if
debatable
means,
on the
if he can run 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, debatable on the... He's a super genius. I mean, it reminds me, it's like essentially they're saying he can run as fast as Black Panther and Captain America. Mm-hmm. Remember that scene in that movie where they're running in traffic?
Yeah.
And they're running as faster than the cars?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Beast can run that fast.
Now he can.
He can certainly leap incredibly.
Yeah.
All right, whatever. In this movie, they say you can run fast. Uh-huh. Fine. Magneto is training with Professor X, too. Professor X, like, opens up his mind to... He says, like, it's not just accessing rage that makes you powerful. It's also, like, accessing good emotions, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he teaches him he can move a large, like, radio telescope that's in their backyard for some reason.
Right.
So they're all being trained. Oh, and this is where Mystique says 1 week has passed.
Yeah.
That they've all
become
friends.
They had
1 week
of training, and now they're...
ready to fight the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Bonded for life.
All right. In this moment, too, Beast tries to give Mystique the drug to cure her appearance, not her powers.
Right.
Which is an awfully specific cure he's invented. He tries it on himself, backfires, he turns into the Blue Beast, which is, like, enough close to the comics that it's like kind of like a good nod to the fans.
Yeah.
Beast experimented on himself at some point in the comics, much later than when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns into the Blue Guy. Like, it's weird how they go away from this in the future movies. They don't want that actor in the makeup the whole time. So they say he invents more serums that allows him to change back and forth between Beast and human.
Yeah.
Which has never been part of the Beast character, at least as far as I know.
Right.
Which is kind of like defeats the purpose. It also like fucks up the continuity in the end of X-Men Apocalypse because Kelsey Grammer returns and he's a Blue Guy fully.
Yeah.
So it is at that point where you assume that Nicholas Hoult stops taking the drugs. Like, I don't know what the fuck.
I don't know either.
Yeah. So, he turns into the Beast. The Cuban Missile Crisis is happening. They have to stop Shaw. A Beast also invents them a bunch of uniforms they wear, which are, like, fairly...
I like this set of uniforms, actually.
It's close enough to the original 60s comics. They look tasteful.
They're not ridiculous.
Yeah, I never loved...
They're jumpsuits, so yeah. I mean, they're like a little silly, but as jumpsuits go, they're not ridiculous.
They're subtle, they're tasteful. Like, I never loved the Jack Kirby original comics costumes.
Uh-huh.
I love the giant... Once they start going to giant-size X-Men, I love them more, where they just all have unique different colors and stuff. And then going for the Jim Lee era, his redesigns are awesome, too.
Yeah.
I never loved the original blue and yellow X-Men deal, which is we're going to get more of in the Dark Phoenix movie.
I mean, it makes sense that they would be unified as a team and all wear the same outfit, you know, like a sports team would.
Initially,
but
it makes sense to...
In terms of, like, differentiation as you're reading a comic, it's kind of nice when they each have their own, like, set of colors. It's like a visual shorthand.
Yeah,
know?
And I also like that they're individuals as they get along further in the comics, too. They're not, like, a regimented team.
Yeah.
You know, the Fantastic Four all wear the same costumes. Right. I think that makes more sense as a group.
Mm. Anyway.
Whatever, yeah. So the costumes look okay. They're flying into battle. And, you know, like, I was like, the movie to me is really dragging at this point. I've seen this movie a lot of times. Mm-hmm. It's just gotten worse for me over the years, even though I liked it initially.
Yeah.
But this final battle sequence I thought was still good.
Yeah.
I glued in more as we watched. They're flying over the waters of Cuba. The two navies are intersecting. They have to avert the crisis. You know, I thought the CGI was pretty good with all these scenes, the flying, the planes. There's some, like, really, like, bizarre flat shots of the boat admirals and commanders, like, that look really stupid. Like, Michael Ironside is inexplicably in these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, a famous actor. Like, why does he show up for just this ending as, like, a generic American commander in a boat?
Yeah.
I don't know. But, you know, they're trying their best. Shaw's trying to light a flame to the conflict. The X-Men are trying to avert it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, a fight breaks out between Azazel and Riptide and the ancillary X-Men characters. It's, like, pretty good. Like, they're flying around the boats, like, teleporting. You know, I didn't think it was that bad. I liked when Banshee dropped into the water and shot a sonic wave at the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
I like when I thought a great scene was when Magneto's hanging off the Blackbird, lifting the submarine out of the ocean and crashing onto the beach. And also, simultaneously, the Blackbird crashes onto the beach, too.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that.
Yeah, all of it looked good, I thought. You know?
The final confrontation between Magneto and Shaw was, like, it's not bad because they're both good actors and...
Mm-hmm.
Michael Fassbender especially is really good, and he gets his revenge, and Professor X is, like, trying to stop Magneto, even though Magneto says explicitly to him earlier, I'm gonna kill Shaw.
Right.
And,
Professor X is like, don't do it, it's not
worth
it.
Won't bring you peace.
Yeah.
But, like, really,
but, on the other hand, it's like, this guy's out to revenge his mother's death by like, a horrible, like, Nazi madman.
And he's also trying to nuke the entire planet. Like, if any criminal deserved to die, Shaw does.
Yeah.
Magneto's totally justified in trying to kill him. This guy needs to be brought to his knees. Like,
this scene is just odd, right? Because it's like Magneto, okay, he, like, gets into the chamber where Shaw's holding onto the nuclear thing.
Yeah, the nuclear rods.
And so then Professor X can, like, mentally access the chamber for, like, a little bit.
Right.
And so Magneto, he freezes Shaw.
He has to get the helmet off Shaw. He has the Magneto helmet.
Right, exactly. And Magneto, like... So that's the origin of the Magneto helmet that
he
get right
takes
there,
because
he,
yeah,
like, puts it on his head so that Professor X can't get to him. But Professor X is still back there, like, yelling. Like,
in the plane.
He's by himself.
Always with Mora is, like, the only witness to this.
Right, exactly. But nobody around him can, like, see what's going on the other end that he can telepathically see, you know? So he's, like, screaming his head off and crying. He's having, like, a really emotional, like, time there.
Why does he want Magneto not to kill Shaw? Like, I get, like, he doesn't want Magneto to be a killer.
Yeah, that's it.
It's not... But what's he gonna do with Shaw once he... Shaw's so dangerous. Like, nothing can seemingly stop him.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, anyway, Magneto gets the upper hand. He kills Shaw with the Nazi coin that was given to him in the beginning of the movie. Pretty brutally drives it through his skull.
Yeah.
I don't get, like, if Shaw is charged with so much atomic energy, like, they show a scene of him just walking. Like, Magneto's trying to, like, bring down metallic girders on him from the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And Shaw's just walking and the girders fly away because he's just charged with so much energy.
I don't know.
Like, I feel like he's still charged with the energy. Wouldn't the coin just deflect off his skin? I don't know.
Nope.
Yeah, nope, right, yeah. So he kills him. It's actually pretty brutal because, like, you wonder, like, what happens to Professor X when he's in the mind of somebody who is being killed.
Uh-huh.
I guess he experiences the death in a weird way along with him. That's why maybe he's so emotional.
Maybe.
Anyway, Magneto flies out with Shaw, like, in a crucifix pose.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's just really weird. Then he drops him, so goes, you hear splat noise.
Yeah.
It's really horrible. And Magneto's like, all right, mutants, you all have to join me. Like, Shaw was right, even though he was a dickweed. The humans are a real enemy. And Professor is like, no, you know, I have a dream.
Yeah.
Then he's like, well, I can, they're, now both the Russians and Americans are uniting to shoot their missiles at us, and they do.
Uh-huh.
Professor X stops the missiles.
No, Magneto does.
Right, yeah. Magneto stops the missiles, and he flies them back. Professor X is trying to stop him. It's a pretty dopey scene where they keep cutting to the commander of the boats, like saying, like, oh, it's been a pleasure serving with you men.
Yeah.
Then the missiles would fall into the ocean, some would rise up again because
right.
they're wrestling with Magneto. Eventually, Moira MacTaggert just starts shooting Magneto. He's blocking the bullets, and one that he deflects, like, goes into the base of Professor X's spine,
mm-hmm.
and he's paralyzed. So they're, you know.
Yeah.
He's not paralyzed by the alien known as Lucifer that he met in the Korean War or something from the comics. So that's okay. I mean, I think this is, like, a fine retcon of that.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty stupid, but Magneto yeah. feels like...
It makes them all put aside their differences because everyone loves Charles.
Right. Like, Magneto loves Charles for some reason. Like,
yeah.
I don't get why. They knew each other for 2 weeks. I'm not sure why they're best friends.
I think it's like a meeting of, like, intellectual equals, right?
I know, but that's still, it's like, he's really upset of what's happened. It's kind of tragic. He blames Mori, tries to kill her, but Professor's like, no, it was your fault.
Yeah.
And then I guess Magneto realizes, all right, I'm just leaving.
Mm.
He grabs some mutants. Mystique decides to join him in the end because there's so much she could take of Professor X's. So we've learned he's a bad therapist from the cartoons. He's also a bad friend.
Yeah,
like, no wonder Juggernaut, like, really hated Professor X as a stepbrother, like, as we've seen how he treats Mystique.
Yeah, really.
So she leaves to join Magneto. They teleport away to Zazel. I guess, does Riptide die? No, he's alive. Angel also is still alive. She's with Magneto, too. And then they go back to the mansion. He forms the X-Men. He says, I'm going to open a school here. He's talking to Moira. Oh, Moira. Oh, and then at this point, he kisses Moira and erases her memories of, like, the last couple weeks.
Right.
For some fucking reason. It makes no sense.
Because discretion is, like, a concern for him. Because
she works at the CIA.
Right. And he's like, no one can ever know, like, where I am or something. And she's like, I would never tell anyone where you are. Again, doesn't really make sense because we know, like, in the future of the X-Men, like, Xavier becomes a notorious mutant and like people know because,
world famous.
Yeah,
it also doesn't make sense because the CIA seemed to like know about everything that's happened up until like a week ago,
right?
And she just can't remember those 2 weeks, and
so like the whole
there's more
CIA
misogyny there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, she's like, I remember a kiss, and they're like, oh, this is why a woman can't be in the CIA.
Yeah.
And that was like really, we need to go back to that moment.
All right.
She also gives him the name the X-Men. Like, before he erases her memories.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, they're like your X-Men. He's like, oh, I rather like that. Maybe one day I'll go bald. You know, some dumb references. And then Magneto breaks Emma Frost out of the CIA prison. He's like, come join me. And I really loved Magneto's outfit here. Nice crimson-red shaded outfit. And the helmet never looked better in any of the movies. And they do not use this helmet again going forward. It's like a shiny chrome red-crimson helmet with the purple stripe, bull stripe.
And the little points on the front.
Yeah, with like the emblem on top. It's like as comic accurate as possible. And they do not have the guts to use it in any future movies. They go back to the dull, faded one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you see his band of mutants. It actually looked kind of cool. I like that scene of them. They look well-framed.
Hmm.
The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And then the movie ends.
Phew.
Yeah.
What a relief.
You've heard all our complaints. I mean, like, people really like this movie. Like, major critics like this movie. People on the internet in famous review sites, like, this is, like, they hold this up as being, like, the best, like, X-Men movie.
So why? What are the positives that we skipped over here?
I just think they haven't watched it since it came out in the theaters, and they just remember McAvoy and Fassbender being really good.
Uh-huh.
And there's a big bias against Bryan Singer, which I think is fair, and people like the movies of Matthew Vaughn.
Mm.
So I think that, like, those elements in their mind, like, they say, like, this is, like, the best X-Men movie. Beyond that, if you watch this movie, as we just did, and we're huge X-Men fans, and we are not, like, even though we talk a lot about being comic accurate, we don't give a shit if the movie's good. It's just not a good movie. I mean, the script is bad, the dialogue is bad.
Yes, it shits
on the X-Men continuity in a way that X-Men Origins Wolverine did.
You know, it's a little disappointing because I'm willing to forgive a lot in movies as long as they're engaging. And
yeah,
there was a good, I don't know, 20 minutes to a half hour in the middle here where I was, like, squirming in my chair.
Yeah, I know. I was angry. I mean, like, I'll like a bad Marvel movie. I like Dolph Lundgren's The Punisher. You know, like, I'll sit through a dumb movie if it's fun.
Yeah.
X-Men Wolverine Origins, I had more fun watching it last week than I had watching this.
Despite all our complaints about that one.
But it was fun to complain about it. It was like, that movie was goofy and stupid. And, like, I was sitting there eating popcorn.
Yeah.
That we made. I was enjoying myself from start to finish. This movie, I was just, like, bored a lot of it. And it looking at it with a critical eye, you know, preparing for this podcast, I was able to formulate a lot of the reasons why I personally, like, think it's lacking.
Yeah.
I mean, is that how you feel about it, too, or?
It's not as good as I remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only seen it, well, in the theaters, and then maybe, like,
once
or twice since
then. I've seen it a lot more than you.
But even then, now that I think about it, in rewatching it, it's not like I sat down and, like, sat through the entire movie engaged the whole time. It would be like I'd turn it on and then I'd, like, wander away and do something else and then come back and be like, oh yeah, this movie's on, and watch for a few minutes, like. So clearly it's not that it was that good that I, like, would get sucked into it, you know, like you do with some movies.
You know, for it being, like, a unique, fresh take on the X-Men in a different time period and an attempt to reboot the franchise, it really did feel like a big studio movie with a lot of studio notes.
Yeah.
It felt edited very strangely. I just felt like it was a lot of stuff is just brushed over on your brain and you're just supposed to accept, like, transitions between scenes.
Yeah.
And it's just the character building, you're just relying on the performances of the characters that you like and the actors that you like, but, like, really it's not there in the script.
But also, it's like we've said before, this was at a point where there still wasn't that much X-Men content out there for, like, ready consumption.
Right, this was like an attempt at making, like, a good X-Men movie.
For us, I think a lot of it was like, more is better at that point, whereas now we're at a point where more is not necessarily better, because we've seen, like, a pretty wide range of...
I would say, like, the thing that had me most excited for when we saw it initially and why I liked it was that it was a superhero period piece movie.
Yeah.
Which is an idea I had for years prior to that. Like, you could take my word for that or not.
Yeah.
But, like, I was always like, you know, if they reboot Superman or Batman, set it in the frickin', like, late 1930s when the characters came out. Like, I think that would be a really cool world. You know, Batman of the 30s, like, done.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I mean, that's so much of why the Batman cartoon was successful, because it was in this amorphous time frame.
Right.
Was it the modern day? Was it the 1940s or whatever? And that's what we just said about Legion, why it's so cool. It's, like, in this fictional, like, time-verse.
Right.
Where it's just, like, it's got, like, stylistic elements. It's not anything. It's not any time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that could work. Like, I'd love to see a Spider-Man movie that takes place in 1963, whenever the character premiered.
Mm.
I think that's just, like, an interesting take.
Yeah.
Same thing with... And a lot of people on the internet have suggested this. When you reboot the Fantastic Four, it should start in the 1960s and then have them time warp to the future.
Mm.
And that's how they join the MCU. Like, they've been lost in, like, the negative zone or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think that's a cool idea.
Yeah, that is
so
cool.
So I think there's, like... And Captain Marvel, new movie, it's going to be a period piece set in, like, the early 90s. I think there's something to be said about doing a period piece superhero movie. I think it could work. I think you should do it more boldly and more accurate to the period. Like, if I saw a Superman movie in the 1930s or 40s, I would do a World War II Superman. Like, you know, like, jingoistically, during World War II, Superman fought in World War II in the comics.
Yeah.
You knew that, right? Like,
right.
Like, there was just, you know, like, all the comic heroes would go, like, you know...
Whatever the war
sell
of the day
boar
is.
Bonds, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, war bonds. What are they called? War
yeah.
bonds?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, so Superman would be, like, punching a tank in, like, the 1944 issue of Superman, right?
Yeah.
So I would do a movie where young Clark Kent joins, like, the army.
I want to see even before that. I want to see, like, the 1930s before World War II,
yeah.
like, really hits American, you know,
yeah.
like, people in patriotism.
Yeah.
Like, what is Superman up to at that point?
That's
like,
a good idea. Yeah, right. It's just interesting. There's a lot of fertile ground there,
yeah.
you know? Same thing for Batman. But anyway.
Yeah.
So this movie, like, that idea alone is interesting, but they just don't execute it well. it's kind of a shame.
I'm disappointed.
Yeah, so I know a lot of our fans probably love this movie, too. I mean, like, it's just, for me,
I did love it the first time I saw it, though. That's, like, the weirdest thing is I feel like every time I've watched it, I get, like, a little more critical of it, maybe because more content has come out in the meantime. Mm-hmm. But this time was, like, it was just disappointing.
I mean, I think the main reason to love it is because it's cast so well. You've got James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender as the two leads, and they're excellent actors.
Yeah, they are.
And they, like, bring a lot to these really cool characters. It'll be interesting when we do Days of Future Past.
I think Wolverine is next. Oh, yeah.
Which will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
But Days of Future Past, I'm just going to say right now, without having rewatched it, I think is a better movie than this one.
Mm.
It's a return to Bryan Singer, who we all know has his problems.
Yeah.
But we'll see. You know, maybe we'll rewatch that and not like it or like it more. But anyway, that's all we have for this one. I don't want to keep belaboring this. Follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Join the X-Men Task Podcast Facebook group. Search out X-Men Task Podcast. You can listen to join the community, talk with us, tell us why you love X-Men First Class. In fact, I would actually love to hear from all of you if you like the movie.
Brighten our spirits about this movie again.
Yeah, please defend it and tell me if Beast's mutant power includes super intelligence. I don't think it does, but let us know.
Just be smart and not have it be a mutation.
I think that's what the case is, but yeah. Well, I don't know. Join that and rate and review us on your podcast service. Give us 5 stars. That'd be really nice. Sonia, any final words before we escape late into the night here on Saturday?
That's all, folks.
All right. Good night, everybody.